This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. There are so many things going on in state government we may not be aware of because not everything grabs headlines. With us now to go over what's been happening this past week and things we should be paying attention to is Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk about some of the biggest bills that are making their way to the governor's desk. Maybe after this week, are there any that seem to have a chance?
Oh, I think almost all of them have a chance. Vetoes have been very rare for at least a decade here in Indiana. Certainly when you have a governor and a legislature of the same party, that tends to happen. We of course, know that there's one bill for sure this year that the governor will veto, which is House Bill 1123, which allows lawmakers to call themselves into special session. This is a reaction to the COVID-19 pandemic and lawmakers feeling left out of the process last year as the governor was making all of these executive orders and you know, reacting to the pandemic. The governor has already said he's going to veto that because he believes it's unconstitutional. That is a very open question that a lot of people disagree on. Beyond that, I'm not sure there's anything that I would say is headed for a veto. So generally speaking, when you see a bill being sent to the governor, it's going to get signed into law.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those big bills? You mentioned this thing for lawmakers. Is there anything else that's pretty big?
Yeah, there's been several bills this session that are really reacting to things that happened last year. Obviously, a lot of the COVID-19 pandemic, whether directly or indirectly, has affected what lawmakers are doing. And there's a couple of them that go to that this year. So, for instance, one that's headed to the governor's desk this week gets into that whole idea of the things that Governor Holcomb did last year through executive order. So early in the pandemic, when he issued his stay-at-home order and restricted gatherings to no more than 10 people, social distancing, mask wearing, all of that, he applied those, at the very beginning at least, to churches as well as almost everybody else except for essential businesses. A lot of lawmakers were very, very, very unhappy about that. And there's been legislation steadily moving through the General Assembly this session and now is headed to the governor's desk that would bar the governor or any local government from ever again in a public emergency restricting the right of worship. So what lawmakers have said that means is the literal worship services. So you can't stop people from going to church in whatever numbers, social distancing be damned. That they want. It also says other religious activities. So basically anything that isn't the worship service. So if you run a religious institution runs a daycare or a food pantry or, you know, whatever it is that isn't the worship service, they could not be restricted by the governor or local government any more than you restrict essential services. So if Walmart is open, the church is open for all of their activities too. But if you impose a gathering limit of 25% capacity on Walmart, that 25% capacity would apply to what the church is doing other than worship services. So that's headed to the governor this week. Another bill headed to the governor that's attracted quite a bit of attention is a bill that requires local governments to prioritize protecting monuments, statues, memorials, and other commemorative property, religious, public, and private. And it says if local governments don't prioritize that, they could lose out on some state funding that the state government sends to local governments. It also says that the state police have to prioritize investigating anyone who damages, defaces, vandalizes, destroys monuments, statues, etc. This is a reaction to something that happened last year, not COVID-19, but of course the Black Lives Matter protests that we saw around the country and here in Indiana. Now, what opponents of this bill say is, what does prioritize mean? Are you prioritizing investigating some kid spray painting a statue over rape and murder? And what authors of the bill and supporters of the bill say is, well, we didn't say what prioritize means. It just has to be a priority, not the top priority, which to me undercuts the actual bill. But I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a legislator. So that that one's been attracting some attention for perhaps not positive reasons across the board. But again, I don't expect the governor to veto anything other than the one bill I already mentioned that he has announced that he will veto.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to talk a little bit about this monument protection bill. Is this unusual in Indiana for lawmakers to be very concerned about inanimate objects?
This is obvious. I mean, one lawmaker, Democratic Representative Ed Delaney, who was speaking on the floor about the bill this week, in opposition to it, I should stress, said that this is a message bill, that they're just trying to send a message and using state law to do it. And I think that's true. I think even supporters of the bill would say that's true to a certain extent. Originally, the bill didn't include, like, a lot of this language about you have to do this, you have to do that. It was just a policy statement. It was, we believe that prioritizing protection of monuments, et cetera, should be the policy of, et cetera, et cetera. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're trying to send a message with this one. The question is, will it ever be used? There are a lot of, like, the local government can't be held responsible for not protecting the monuments if it would put police lives in danger, or if there's something more important that police have to do, or if they don't have enough resources, or and so on mm-hmm. and so on. So I think there's a real question as to whether or not this law would ever be enforced or used in any way. So it does seem like it's a bit more of a message than anything else, but lawmakers are going to make laws to do whatever it is that they want to do.
Right. And is there anything in this particular bill, like, is there a cost to implementing those types of things that they've included that may affect taxpayers?
Well, I mean, it would certainly affect taxpayers if they use the law to cut off funding to local governments. I mean, it's not entirely clear who decides that a local government didn't adequately protect a monument. It's not clear who decides that, how it's decided. And then it's not exactly clear how a state agency would go about deciding what to withhold and how much of it. There are some parameters around what they can withhold. It can't be any funding. Like, for instance, there's a lot of funding that flows from the state to local governments. The gas tax, for instance, is collected at the state level, but a lot of it goes on to local governments to take roads and such. That wouldn't be affected by this because of the way the bill is worded, things like that. But there are grant programs. There's a lot of money that goes to police departments across the state that is so-called discretionary funding, which is what the bill says you can withhold. And so, as one lawmaker pointed out in debate on this bill, okay, well, Republicans are voting to defund the police under this bill, which I don't think Republicans would agree with, both the idea of defunding police as well as that they're doing that. But that is technically what the bill says. So that could have an impact on taxpayers. But again, I think there's a lot of question whether this law would ever actually be used.
Mm-hmm. And are you seeing more laws this year compared to pre-COVID that are more reactive rather than proactive?
No, there's always bills like this. We're seeing perhaps more of them this year only because there's so much more to react to. And we're seeing there are other bills, for instance, that were sort of targeting reactive bills, targeting things that happened over the last year or two that haven't advanced through the process. There's a bill about the state basically taking over a local prosecutor's office if they decide not to charge certain crimes. And that's very reactive, principally to something the Marion County Prosecutor's Office announced a couple years ago about no longer prosecuting low-level simple possession of marijuana. But that didn't make it through the House, so that bill is almost certainly dead now. But there's so much to react to with COVID on a lot of different scales. And some of it is what I think everybody agrees is very positive. Some of it is a little more divisive. For instance, a positive one is telehealth, which is on a fast track to the governor's office, to the governor's desk for his signature. The governor during the pandemic, through executive order, expanded telehealth in Indiana dramatically to a lot more services, because obviously that was going to be the best thing for people who didn't want to go to the doctor in person during this pandemic. Now they want to put that in state law. That's reactive, certainly, but everybody loves that idea. It clearly worked in the pandemic. It can clearly work going forward, even out of the pandemic. So, yeah, there's always reactive things like this. There's some lawmakers who want to get attention for reacting to something they saw in the news and they were very upset about. But sometimes they make it through, sometimes they don't. This one made it through.
And what about this 2-year state budget proposal from the, I believe it's the Senate Republicans?
Yeah, that was the latest step in the budget process. Now both chambers, the Senate and the House, will finalize the budget over the next couple of weeks before they leave for the session for this year. A couple of the biggest things that the Senate Republican budget did, one, they did not spend nearly as much money in education funding. And it's important to note, education funding, K-12 education funding, makes up 50% of the $36 billion state budget. So it's by far the biggest piece of the pie. They spent a little more on kids in poverty and a little less on expanding private school vouchers than the House Republican budget did. Now, House Republicans believe very strongly in expanding vouchers as much as they expanded them. And so that'll be an interesting fight we watch play out over the next 2 weeks before we see what the final version of the budget does. The other big thing that I think the Senate Republican budget did is start to spend some of the new federal COVID-19 relief money that's coming to Indiana. There's about $3 billion the state will have to spend out of the American Rescue Plan. And lawmakers are starting to take a crack at where they think that money should go. They have said, though, that they don't plan to say where all of it should be spent because they think some of it should be held back, sit on some of it. You have until 2024 to spend this federal money. And they think they should wait. The state should wait at least a little while because, as Senate Republican budget architect Ryan Mishler said this week, we don't know what's still to come in the future. There could be things out there that we couldn't possibly prepare for. It would be nice to have some of that money around just in case.
Mm-hmm. And real quick, any sense that the governor will bring back the mask mandate as cases are skyrocketing across the country?
I am personally very doubtful.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Coming up, evictions and fair housing in Indiana. Are things getting worse or better? If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Each week, Indiana Public Broadcasting sends a question via text to listeners across the state. Last week, it was all about outdoor hobbies and the pandemic. We caught up with Matt Lomax of Indianapolis. Let's take a listen. Did you go outside more or start an outdoor hobby due to the pandemic?
I wouldn't say I started an outdoor hobby. I would say that we accelerated, my entire family, we accelerated our outdoor hobbies. I've always been a big fan of camping, fishing, boating, things like that. And that we definitely did more of that last year and are planning to do a lot more of it this year.
Did you feel like you had a lot more time with things kind of locked down last year?
I personally didn't have a lot more time. My industry for work, we've been very busy, fortunately for us. I know a lot of people are struggling. We are not. But we did have more free time with my wife making a transition to working from home, my kids being a little more flexible with the online learning. We definitely had some more time to spend together in the evenings and on the weekends.
So you mentioned that a lot of people kind of accelerated their outdoor activity around you, and you yourself included. Was this new for anyone at all around you, the activities that you were doing outdoors?
Yeah, to an extent. So we camp a lot. My immediate family, my wife and I have two children. We camp a lot, and we camp with a couple of my cousins and their, you know, families, and my uncle. We've all camped together a lot. My sister and her husband did go out and buy a camper last year, and so did one of my cousins. So our group has grown a little bit, and our group has invested a little more money and effort into the camping trips now, as we're going to be taking three campers instead of just the one. So, it certainly grew in that aspect.
And so with the vaccine now becoming more available, do you think that's going to encourage you to camp more with other people outside of your family?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, campgrounds are social places. We that's part of what we like about it. And lakes and boating the same sort of way. So yeah, we're looking forward to being able to go out and actually interact around the campgrounds more, around campground organized activities, things like that. A lot of those things were cut back a lot last year. So campgrounds were open and you could go to camp, but some of the you know, the naturalist services or the nature centers or, you know, certain trails or things that you would do at the campgrounds or in the state parks were closed or reduced or, you know, shuttered in some way. So we're looking forward to all those things being opened back up so we can fully enjoy the experience when we're in the park for the weekend.
And that was Indiana Public Broadcasting listener Matt Lomax. To join Indiana Public Broadcasting's weekly text club for news updates and to share your questions and experiences, text the word Indiana to 73224. The pandemic has highlighted many inequities across the country and here in Indiana. We've mentioned some of those on our program, from health disparities to life expectancy, but what about housing? Early on in the pandemic, that was one of the issues we may have heard about, since people were being told to stay at home. What were their options if that meant they wouldn't be able to pay their rent? With us now to talk more about this is Amy Nelson, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana. Welcome, Amy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking you about this fact that some of us may hear. Indiana is often referred to as number two in the nation when it comes to evictions. What exactly does that mean?
Well, before the pandemic, Indiana already, as we say at the Fair Housing Center, already had an eviction problem. It already had a substandard housing problem. It had an affordability problem, and then it had a housing discrimination problem. And evictions are kind of the end result of a lot of those things being mixed together. And what occurred was that entities such as Eviction Lab, which is a group that was run by Matt Desmond, who wrote the phenomenal book Evicted, started actually putting some data to this. And so it's an online site you can go take a look at. They used basically 2016 court data that they got at the time. And for Indiana and Indianapolis in particular, let's take Indianapolis, for instance. Indianapolis was ranked 14th highest in the country of large cities for just the sheer number of eviction filings. And then it was second highest in the country for actual court-ordered evictions, where somebody is actually forced out. So that moves beyond just being filed with an eviction, but then are actually forced out. And we're only behind New York City, believe it or not, which is certainly a drastic difference in population.
So I know you mentioned there are so many different elements that happen before it gets to the point where someone is evicted. I want to talk about those as well, but just for our listeners who are tuning in, you know, sometimes when we hear the word eviction, we imagine, like, I don't know, a Hollywood movie where the sheriff shows up and knocks on the door and then throws your stuff out. What exactly does that process look like?
Well, I am not an attorney and do not handle, you know, evictions directly. What we tend to do here at the Fair Housing Center is certainly work within the Indiana General Assembly to try to make sure consumers and tenants are better protected under housing laws. Here in Indiana, you know, your things can be essentially out in the street if you actually don't vacate the property by a court-ordered date. As part of that. So certainly that can, you know, be part of the process occurred. I think overwhelmingly people do tend to move out before that date comes, but, you know, you can see the boxes on the street and everybody's personal belongings if somebody's not out by a specified court, you know, assigned date.
Mm-hmm. And with the pandemic, we've heard that, you know, a lot of people were struggling that maybe weren't struggling before the pandemic. Did you see that in the work that you do, that there were people who may have been living paycheck to paycheck and just barely making rent, and now they're in a completely different category?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that what the pandemic showed, because of where the job loss was really targeted, is it was a lot of people who are already housing insecure, but it was also people who, hadn't had problems in making their rent, you know, each month. These weren't necessarily wealthy individuals, but it was individuals with consistent, you know, paychecks. But because of the loss to service industries, restaurants, bars, you know, those movie theaters, all of that, all those jobs being taken away. Even individuals that have had, you know, consistent paychecks ended up struggling in this area with their loss of the job. And then how do you make rent each month when, you know, your general housing needs haven't changed, and but yet your income has changed dramatically.
There's a CDC temporary order on certain types of residential evictions. I saw that on the state's website. I did reach out to the state and haven't heard back, but so I don't really know what their plans are for this. Have you heard anything on what Indiana is doing to comply with the CDC order?
Well, it is a federal order, and it's been, essentially been extended. It was set to expire March 31st, and it's now been extended. You know, it is the Fair Housing Center's position that although we have appreciated the CDC eviction order, because that's been the only moratorium in place since last August, essentially, but that does not end up helping that many people. You have to meet pretty stringent requirements in order to qualify under that moratorium. And then even if you qualify in your moratorium, landlord can still take you to court. It'll be up to a judge to ultimately decide if you actually qualify under that eviction moratorium to stay in your property. And then the moratorium, though, also only protects eviction due to non-payment of rent related to the COVID pandemic. Well, if your landlord now all of a sudden comes in and says, you know what, it isn't just rent payments. We think that they're violating their lease in these number of ways, things that may not have ever been brought up before, but are now being brought up. And that puts the judge in a position where they can lawfully have this eviction occur, because it isn't due then to the non-payment of rent. It's due to these other lease violations that may never have been raised before, but are being raised now.
And that's interesting you're mentioning that, because I was wondering if somebody had taken, I looked at that form and it has like, check this, check that, you know, if you fit these categories, and then present this form to your landlord to show like, I can't pay my rent right now. And I was wondering, would that cause retaliation from the landlord?
You know, it may. Here in Indiana, the Brandon was certainly talking about everything that had been happening in the Indiana General Assembly. Well, there's been a lot of housing things happening in the Indiana General Assembly this year, one of which is the veto override of SCA 148. Here in Indiana, Brandon didn't mention, but here in Indiana, veto overrides just simply have to be, you know, the has to be 51%, essentially. It's not this big barrier. And one of the things the Indiana General Assembly did was to override Governor Holcomb's veto last year of SCA 148. And then by doing that, that allows for expanded evictions, more types of evictions that will be allowed within 3 days. Again, at a time when, you know, we already have high eviction numbers. We're trying to navigate coming out of this pandemic, getting people back to work, all of that. And then now we have this new law that most of us can't make sense of as to how far it is. Most cities are just trying to figure out now how it's going to impact their local housing code, because it is so broad and still being debated as to what changes are going to be made to it as well.
And so what does it look like so far for folks who are struggling, whether it's paying rent or they're literally getting evicted? What are their resources?
Well, these are really challenging times. I mean, there are the rental assistance programs have restarted back up. They were closed for a significant amount of time, both at the state level as well as at many city levels, including for those of us here in Indianapolis. Those have since reopened. But they, you know, they have, you know, certainly some restrictions on it that might, those programs may not catch everybody up on rent. Then, you know, you need your job to come back. Not only do you need to just get caught up, but then you need your job to, you know, have restarted at, you know, a pay level that you had before that allows you then to start, you know, repaying, you know, your rent again. And again, Indiana has a significant affordability problem. We have so many people living in substandard housing because that's the housing that they can afford. And individuals under SCA 148 now cannot be retaliated against, retaliated against for simply doing things like contacting public health or contacting, you know, legal services type agencies. But how many people are going to speak up when, you know, their housing is such at risk right now? And they've read the news stories about how expansive SCA 148 is and how it so shifts so many of the protections to landlords instead of, away from tenants. And that, you know, that's scary. How are we going to navigate that? And I think a lot of that is still to come to be figured out as to how detrimental not only the COVID pandemic is, but also the repercussions of SCA 148.
Mm-hmm. And is there a law right now in Indiana where if someone is evicted, they'll have a hard time finding future housing?
Not necessarily a law, but it is the process that many multifamily property use. Most companies will use background check companies to determine if a tenant should be rented to or not. And typically part of that, those companies will review things like criminal history, your FICO score, but also any court records. And, you know, here in Indiana, our courts, our eviction court, our small claims court records are accessible to the general public, and they scrape that data from those courts, but they don't necessarily distinguish between an eviction that was filed versus an actual justified court ordered one as part of that. And so just that filing of eviction, which many people who qualify for rental assistance and their landlord refused to participate in the program or ended up being evicted and having to fight that because they felt they qualified through the CDC moratorium, now are carrying that eviction filing with them. And it is going to impact their ability to get into future safe and affordable housing because those checks are going to show that they have this eviction filed against them. And there's nothing to stop a landlord here in Indiana from refusing to rent to somebody because they had an eviction the last 7 years, filing mm-hmm. in the last 7 years.
And what about with fair housing? I know you work a lot in that area. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's being done and how April plays a significant role?
Yeah, so happy Fair Housing Month. Every April nationally celebrated as Fair Housing Month to kind of honor and celebrate the original passage of the Fair Housing Act, the Fair Housing Act back in April 1968. It was passed on April 11th, 1968. And so across the country, we all do a number of different events. We still have a long way to go in addressing housing discrimination. We have certainly seen that here in the past year with the regrowth of the racial justice movement, issues around, you know, disability rights that are not being met, the systemic policies still impacting our neighborhoods today. So the Fair Housing Center actually just yesterday at our annual conference released a new history of sales discrimination video. And that is on our YouTube page. And then we have a number of other this month to draw attention to how housing discrimination is still impacting so many people's lives.
And for people who may not be aware of the housing discrimination situation, what are like the most common, I guess, themes that you find in this realm of your work?
Yeah, so the most common allegations that we receive, which are violations of fair housing law, tend to target disability, race, national origin, and gender. So that somebody's treated differently in a housing transaction due to those reasons. So for individuals with disabilities, that might be that a landlord refuses to let them install a ramp at a step or refuses to let them bring an animal in that they need for helping them with their disability. On race, that's far more complicated. We see cases involving lenders refusing to make loans to African Americans and Blacks. We also see, you know, rental discrimination happening in that area. We see what we call reverse redlining, which is targeting of Black and Latino communities here in Indianapolis with predatory rent-to-own or land contracts as part of that. We've seen discriminatory appraisals making the news a lot lately. That's been something that my office has been investigating. How does race play a role in how your home is valued? And is there a difference in how your home is valued just because you live in a Black neighborhood instead of a white neighborhood? All of those type of issues are covered under fair housing laws and continue to haunt our country still today.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the ways that if folks are experiencing these issues, where can they turn?
Well, they can certainly go to our website at fhcci.org or contact our office if they have a question. We are a small staff of five. We're the only such organization in the state of Indiana. States around us all have several. but we do our absolute best to try to inform you about what your rights and options are. And we have a lot of materials on our website and social media to help educate the public about their rights so that they can identify housing discrimination if it occurs and report it and hopefully get it stopped.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Amy Nelson, Executive Director of the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana. It's been a pleasure. We'll be back after a quick break to learn more about the impending cicada infestation and the return of a stolen police car to Crown Point decades after it was taken. If you have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Or you can send us a voice message, a digital voice message, without making a call. You just have to use our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop, free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's VOXPOP. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back after a short break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. I want to say thank you to Adam, our engineer, for playing that music. I think it really sets the tone for this segment because the cicadas are coming, or are they locusts? All I know is they're big, they're noisy, and potentially edible. And we do hear about their return every decade or so. So here to tell us more about these insects is Armin Mocek, professor of biology at Indiana University. Armin, I recently came across a story that mentioned the Blood X cicada emerging this summer, and the name sounds very sci-fi. Can you tell us about this emergence?
Yeah, so thanks for having me. Brood X is a brood of cicadas that are cycling every 17 years. It is actually composed of three separate species, but depending on exactly where you are located geographically, you may actually just encounter one of them or two, or maybe if you're lucky, all three of them. It is by far the most extreme coordinated mass emergence of cicadas in the world. And the whole thing itself is an extraordinarily rare phenomenon. There are about 3,300 described species of cicadas worldwide, but there are only a handful that undergo this mass emergence and this periodical cycling in their emergence. Brood X just simply happens to be the most extreme of them all.
Okay, and I do need to clarify. I said Blood X, but it's Brood X. I guess I had a typo there. But you're saying they're the most extreme of them all. This sounds scary. What do you mean by extreme?
They're the most abundant. Okay. It's going to be millions and millions and millions. And South Central Indiana is basically at the epicenter of all of this. So it's you know, for the past 16 years, it was hard to notice their existence. No one's going to miss them this summer.
Yeah, I'm guessing that they're going to be very noisy. I do want to talk about that in a moment. But just to clarify, there's a difference between cicadas and locusts. And I say this because I always thought it was just depending on where you lived, you called them a different thing. But can you tell us a little bit about the difference?
So both terms are used interchangeably, and sometimes they're meant to refer to the exact same thing. So periodical cicadas, cicadas in general, often get referred to by locusts. People who study insects reserve the term locust for grasshoppers. Where they intersect is that a subset of grasshoppers also undergo these mass migrations, I should say, not these necessarily coordinated emergences, but these mass migrations. And this is where the biology overlaps a bit. But other than that, they're completely different animals. All they share is that they all belong to insects.
And so with these things that we hear about swarms coming every few decades, is this something the folks who are near this epicenter are going to see just a swarm of cicadas and not be able to see the sky, or is that more of a myth?
Not quite like that, but close. So they will start coming out in a few weeks. It's a function of the temperature of the soil. It needs to be about 65 degrees Fahrenheit, 5 inches below for them to come out. Different soil exposures lend themselves to warming up more easily than others. So it's not going to be all at once. You may not notice them right away at the end of April. Early May, you probably will notice them. They keep coming out, and then they keep coming out, and then they build up and build up. And then you will still see the sky, but any, you know, if you're in the right place, any trees that are around your house will be full of them, and they'll all be yelling at you. And that'll go on for quite a while.
And so can people eat these? You know, if there's so many and they're abundant, can we use these as a food source?
Of course. And you should definitely try. But it's not commonly done. But that, too, is a bit of it depends on your cultural background. The eating of insects is actually quite common around the world. It just happens to be something that in the U.S. is relegated to freak shows, not something we normally do. But they are a cheap source of lean, high-quality protein. And if you go through the internet, you will find lots of recipes on how to prepare them. And I'm definitely going to try them.
All right. Well, you'll have to let us know how it tastes. I'm just thinking, if they're a lean source of protein, you could maybe, I don't want to sound gross, but like you could grind them up and make like a protein powder or something natural source like that.
Exactly. Okay. And that is being done commercially worldwide using crickets, which are really easy to rear. And they're produced for human consumption, but the same approach is used not quite on crickets, but on what are called black soldier flies. You will find them in your compost to produce feed for livestock. And it's a multi-billion dollar industry already.
All right. So we need to know where to invest, I guess. So when it comes to the cicadas and that noise that they make where they're just nonstop in the evenings, is that part of the mating process? And how can we get them to be quiet? Do we throw something at the tree?
Good luck. So, yes. It's the males that call. They do so by contracting muscles that cause body parts to rub together, thereby producing the noise we hear. I'm fairly certain, I meant to look that up before the show, but failed, but I'm fairly certain they themselves turn their hearing off before they yell. So they can't hear themselves at the moment. They just scream at you. Well, they don't scream at you. They scream at females. And they try to attract females through their call. I don't know how much choice actually goes on in these guys. In crickets, females will evaluate males based on the quality of his call. In these guys, I have no idea whether they actually do that. But yes, it's meant to attract females. Then they mate. Females go off to lay eggs. And that's it. For you to stop them to call, you can throw something at the tree. It'll stop them for exactly, I don't know, 15 seconds, and then they'll resume.
Okay, so then that's another business idea, to find a way to get them to be quiet. So one last question for you I wanted to know about is that when we see the reemergence of cicadas, is that a good sign for the environment?
I would say generally yes. So there's underground for 17 years. Just imagine all the things that have happened during this time: housing developments, global climate change, increasing spring flood, summer drought conditions for South Central Indiana. All this translates the loss of tree diversity that we have. So seeing these guys coming out, period after period, is a sign that they at least managed to withstand all these onslaughts. Or conversely, if they stop coming out in the numbers that we are used to, it's yet another sign that we are not taking care of the environment the way we should be.
Mm-hmm. And Anna, that's what I was wondering, is if scientists would be worried if this wasn't happening this summer.
I would definitely be worried. Yes, absolutely. So it's one of the many things I monitor, and that if they play out normally, it gives me comfort. And if they don't, they add to my worry.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Armin, for joining us. We really appreciate your insight. And if you have any recipes, please share them with us. I'd like to try a new source of protein. Thank you, Armin Mocek, professor. Thank you, professor of biology at Indiana University. If you have a question or comment, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail at 866-476-3881. Now we're going to shift to a topic that Adam Pinsker, a reporter out of WTIU-WFIU, has been following for some time, and that's the history of the notorious gangster John Dillinger. I want to play Pinsker's recent piece, and then we'll talk a little bit more about it with him. Let's take a listen.
In 1934, John Dillinger was one of the most wanted men in America when he broke out of the Lake County Jail in downtown Crown Point using a fake gun. He stole the sheriff's brand new Ford V8 and fled Indiana. The car was later abandoned in Chicago. It was eventually purchased by a Wisconsin man. The car was tracked down in Maine. Roger Pace helped organize the vehicle's return, complete with a parade through downtown Crown Point on Saturday.
We came back the same route that where Dillinger escaped. When he escaped his jail, he went north on Main Street, turned left on 93rd. Our police procession here came on 93rd in the direct route.
The car's original body, lights, and siren are still intact. Plans are being made to permanently display the vehicle somewhere in Crown Point. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Adam Pinsker.
And we have Adam Pinsker with us right now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Miriam. Appreciate it.
So, Adam, give us a little bit of background on who John Dillinger was and how he became one of the most wanted men in America.
Well, John Dillinger is actually a native Hoosier. He was born in Indianapolis in the early part of the last century, and he got into trouble at an early age. His family moved to Mooresville, not too far away, so they could be away from, you know, try to keep him out of the hustle and bustle of Indianapolis, but it didn't work. So he ended up in, eventually committed a robbery and assault, ended up doing a long stint at the Indiana State Prison, where he became even more involved with some famous criminals of the time, some of the 1930s, 1920s gangsters we hear about. And that led him into just tons of bank robberies, I think about 12 throughout Ohio and Indiana and even further out west. And that's how he kind of came into the crosshairs of law enforcement in northwestern Indiana. So he was actually brought back to face trial in northwest Indiana in Lake County because he was robbing a bank in East Chicago, just north of Crown Point. And he was attempting to escape. A police officer confronted him, shot Dillinger three times, but he was wearing a bulletproof vest exchange, Dillinger fired off his machine gun and unfortunately killed that police officer. But he was brought back to Indiana to face trial, and that is where the story gets really, I guess you could say, kind of goes off the rails.
Mm-hmm. And so what was it like covering this story, you know, like kind of retracing these footsteps?
It was like it's really crazy how long ago it was, because he escaped from that jail, stole the sheriff's car, and by the way, they believe she may have been the first female sheriff, if not in Indiana, in the whole United States. But some of her family was there, some of Dillinger's family was there. They bring this car through downtown Crown Point. You would have thought that maybe the Beatles were in town because they had so many people gathered there on Main Street to see it come to town. They went through a lot of effort to bring this car back, and they want to display it. They haven't decided where, but eventually it will be displayed, and it's kind of comes full circle from when he escaped from that jail facility several years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so in your story, you mentioned there was this parade for the return of the car. What was the purpose of that event? Was it like a closure to this chapter in the town's history?
Yeah, you know, it was closure, and they wanted to make sure that it wasn't – I mean, certainly it brought a lot of notoriety to Lake County and Crown Point, but they also want to let people know that, you know, John Dillinger caused a lot of mayhem and people died because of his actions. And, you know, the sheriff at the time, Lillian Hawley, received a lot of flack when he escaped from what was supposed to be an escape-proof jail. And I'm sure some of that may have been because, you know, it's a boys club and she's a woman in sort of a boys club back then as sheriff. So it was to bring closure, but also to kind of, you know, say, hey, look, our town's been known for having Dillinger escape from it. So now we're at least bringing the car back to its rightful owner.
Right, right. And you spoke with Roger Pace, who seemed to be really connected to this story. What was his connection?
He's a local realtor there, and him and another gentleman named Mark Love helped track this car down. It was actually impounded by the Chicago Police Department in the 30s, auctioned off. A guy bought it from Wisconsin, moved to Maine, as you heard in the piece. And I didn't have a whole lot of time to get into it, but basically the state of Maine, after a certain amount of years, just, I guess, purges their DMV records. And if they had not gotten to it before a certain amount of time, they would never have been able to track it down. So, because it had been sitting in that gentleman's son's garage for all this time. So it only has 36,000 miles on it, which is pretty crazy. My car is only 2017, has 38,000 miles on it. So that's pretty crazy, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that car is very valuable to be in good condition. And speaking of which, Roger Pace talked with you about the police car and how it was still intact when they brought it back. Let's take a listen.
It had the original wiper blades still on the car, 87 years in the original wiper blade. It was that intact. It still has the lights, siren, the light here. It's all original to the car.
Was it surprising that the car was in that good of condition? Did you get to see it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I saw it. I looked inside, looked around it. There's a rack in the front of the vehicle. Police cars at that time would keep what they call Tommy guns. They're, you've probably seen them. They have a little cylinder. They're high powered. Every sheriff's office had to get one here in Indiana in the 30s because there's one down here in Monroe County because there's so much gang activity and they needed it. But so there's a holster for that in the front. The siren is actually in front of the car on the driver's side wheel well, not on top like you see nowadays. So that's just how those vehicles were constructed. And it was brand new. And it was built in 1933. So it had been in the department's care for 4 or 5 months maybe before it was stolen. So it's just really incredible they were able to restore it.
Wow, that's amazing. And there's also the story of the fake wooden gun and how it helped John Doe escape. Roger gave you some background about that, so let's take a listen.
The prevailing theory is that Dillinger's attorney, an unscrupulous attorney out of Chicago, had a Bible, and he hollowed out the form of a wooden gun and placed it in the Bible, knowing that they wouldn't look at a Bible.
I guess that makes me wonder. So back then, nobody checked anything that was being sent to prisoners.
Well, yeah, it does make you wonder. And also, there's another sidebar to that. There's been some reports, depends on which historian you talk to, that Dillinger's cell block was left open and while the inmates were cleaning the area and the jail deputy or attendant went to go get something. So that gave Dillinger a chance to get out of the hallway, and he used that gun to one by one bring jail staff back, and they didn't bother to look. I mean, they're so terrified of Dillinger that they didn't think twice when they saw him holding something that looked like a gun. It's actually on display at the State Police Museum in Indianapolis. You can see it for yourself there. So that gun.
Were you surprised at all by anything that you uncovered while reporting on this?
I was really surprised about how many people turned out to see this car. But I think people were just fascinated because this was a different time in this country, and there was a lot of economic trouble, and they kind of looked at Dillinger as almost like a Robin Hood because he's, you know, people were really despondent, and they looked at Banks as the bad guy, even though he did cause a lot of death and personal injury to people. So that's just the way they were back then.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Adam, for sharing your insight and covering the story. It's really interesting. We look forward to bringing you back again.
Should be fun. Yeah, thank you.
Adam Pinsker is a reporter with WTIU-WFIU. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this afternoon. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brook. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you want to hear this episode again or listen to a past show, you can find All In anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us Monday when we talk about Ramadan and the way COVID-19 has impacted the month of fasting and prayer for Muslims. Don't forget, you can connect with us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. Until next time, I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.